House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 1:10. We're meeting a little bit early today. We swapped off some time with resources last week. I'd like to thank them for accommodating us with us. We have Representative Lynn, Representative Booth, Representative T. Wilson, Representative Holmes, and myself, Chair Olson. We expect that Speaker Chenault to be here briefly. We do have a quorum. First item on the agenda is House Bill 416. I believe that'll be presented by Conrad Jackson to my staff. Or at least I certainly hope that it will be.
We'll do what we can, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Good afternoon, committee members. Before the committee today, House Bill 416, the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. What we're hoping to accomplish here is get the state of Alaska to adopt the same prudent management listings as 47 of the other states. 43, I'm sorry. There's seven that have not. If you take a look in your packet, there's actually a map that shows the majority of the states are on board with this program. if you have taken a look through your packet, you've seen the sponsor statement, the sectional analysis that explains some of the benefits of passage of this bill. We do have a couple people online that are that do work with these institutional funds that can really explain how these the adoption of this act will help in their job on a daily basis, on a yearly basis as things go along. A little bit of history on how we got here. Almost 35 years ago, the Uniform Management of Institutional Funds Act was the law of the land. What we've done is expand that, or what has been done is they've added the prudent, the word prudent, to the management. It cleans up a lot of, I shouldn't say cleans up, it just brings us up to date is really the best way to describe it. It makes two key changes to the institutional fund management and endowment accounting. The first is the elimination of the historic dollar value as a benchmark for both endowment spending and the amount identified for accounting purposes as permanently restricted net assets. The second change is really is clarification and is in the legal classification of earnings. And I'll be here to answer questions. And I believe we have Mr. Lynch with the University of Alaska online, again, who deals with this on a daily basis and can drill down into some of the details. I believe Representative Holmes had expressed interest in a couple of questions some time ago. I'm not sure that she had those answered, but Mr. Lynch is available.
We also have Eric Wolforth and Grant Callow, Eric Callow from the Commission of Uniform Law Commission. He's the Alaska Commissioner. So do you have questions for Conrad, or should we bring in the big guns? Well, thank you, Conrad. I think we'll start with Jim Lynch. Are you with us, Jim?
For the record, my name is Jim Lynch. I'm the treasurer for the University of Alaska Foundation, and I've managed the endowments for the university for the past 25 years or so. I did work with Senator Pascaban on the companion bill. We're at MIFIN. I thought what I'd do is just kind of hit some of the broad highlights and then be available to answer questions if that's acceptable to the committee.
Certainly,
I recognize you're short on time. Basically, the bill sets out responsible practices and standards for investment in nonprofit management of charitable funds. And it's consistent with what the legislature has already adopted for trusts. I think the sponsor mentioned that it's already been adopted by 43 states and the District of Columbia and the U.S. Virgin Islands. It essentially incorporates requirements and considerations that provide for accountability and a determination of what actions really are prudent. It allows allows administrators the flexibility that they need to manage endowments during these volatile market conditions. It's very difficult to manage an endowment when the incomes are jumping up and down every year, and you have a set of beneficiaries, as we have, you know, that are out there waiting for scholarships, and you can't very well just call the students up and tell them that scholarship we promised you last year, the market's been bad, so you can't go to school. So it's difficult to manage in that environment. It clarifies and simplifies the process for dealing with outdated provisions. We don't have too many of those because we're still fairly, Alaska, all the institutions are fairly young. But if you get back to the East Coast, you know, where the colleges and universities have been around for hundreds of years, they have a lot of peculiar provisions that relate to old laws. Reduces the exposure for nonprofit entities and their trustees, and a lot of which are volunteers that are not familiar with all the nuances of endowment administration and managing monies. That it kind of lays out for them what the rules are, and then they know what their responsibilities are. Today, in Alaska, there are no laws that deal with the issues, and it's very difficult to determine what your responsibilities are. There's two provisions in the bill, that two sections that deal address directly the University of Alaska Board of Regents. Primarily, they're there to say that the Board of Regents, you know, will follow the provisions of this bill. And it also corrects what appears to be an unintended consequence of a change in statutory references back in 2005 when the legislature modified the PERS and TERS administration. The Board of Regents authority originally came for investment of funds. The endowments originally came through a cross-reference that basically said the Board of Regents will have the same powers and duties with regard to endowments as the pension committee has, the state pension committee has for the pension funds. They were basically fiduciary responsibilities. When they revised the PERS and TERS program and created the Alaska Retirement Management Board, they created a new statute with a lot of responsibilities that deal directly with pension funds and don't apply to endowment funds, but the reference is now for the Board of Regents is now to that statute. And MIFA here and HB 416 addresses directly the responsibilities that the university has, the Board of Regents have for endowment administration and their nonprofit funds. So that's pretty much what I have, and I think I'll be available to answer any questions that anyone has on the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lynch. Are there any questions for Mr. Lynch? I see at least one. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And due to a glitch in my office, I don't have my marked-up version, so I'm kind of winging it here. But I think that I have two related questions. The first is on page 6 in the definition section. On page 19, it refers to an endowment fund. And reading the definition, it says an endowment fund does not include assets of an institution designated by an institution as an endowment fund for its own use.
I apologize, Representative Holmes. You're breaking up so badly that I can't tell what the question is. If someone else could repeat it, it might help.
Okay, we're working on the sound system here. Is that any better?
Yes, it is better. I'm sorry.
All right, cool. We tried a new mic. All right, I've got two, I think, related questions. The first one has to do with the definition section on page 6, line 19. It defines an endowment fund. And in the definition,
yes.
it says that the term does not include assets of an institution designated by an institution as an endowment fund for its own use, which is sort of what I thought an endowment fund was. So I was hoping you could sort of give me a little bit more plain English description of what actually is covered by the term endowment fund.
The basic definition of an endowment fund is fairly broad, and what the definition is trying to do is exclude those funds which are designated by the institution itself or the board as endowments. And it's what we generally refer to as quasi-endowments. You treat them like endowments, but they are available to creditors mostly. I mean, they're unrestricted. The designation was set up by the administrative board. It can be changed by that board. So that's the distinction between the what we refer to as true endowments versus the quasi-endowments. And what the definition is doing is clarifying that those endowments that are created by a board itself are not controlled by this statute. They are still unrestricted funds, and the board still makes the determinations with regard to those. The others are restricted by donors. And the institution cannot change whatever the restrictions are on those funds when they come in. And, you know, if the donor gives them to the institution and says they're unrestricted, that's fine. You can use them for anything the board chooses. But if they come in and say, you know, this is for the math department or for scholarships or for whatever the purpose is, they can only be used for that, and we have a responsibility to make sure that that's what happens to those funds. So that's the distinction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was
I hope helpful. That was clearer.
That was helpful.
That's question
can
one.
I,
question two.
Can I do my related question now, Mr.
Yeah.
Chairman? That was helpful. On a related note, then going back to page four, I'm looking at subsection C1, which is on line 7, and it talks about designating gifts that certain gifts are create an endowment fund of permanent duration.
That essentially means in perpetuity.
Yeah.
If we receive a donation for someone that's designated as an endowment, then forever the restrictions apply to that money.
So,
and if that endowment was for the math department, forever it's for the math department. And if for some reason we chose to quit teaching math, that probably isn't a good example, but if whatever the need is over time is becomes illegal or improper or we just can't do it, then you have to go back to the courts and leave a court determine what happens to that money. This bill does provide a provision if it's, because it's an expensive process going back, you spend all the money of a small endowment just trying to get it changed. So it made some special provisions the bill provides for if it's less than $50,000 and over 20 years old. There's an expedited procedure. Basically, we notify the AG's office that this is what we plan to do and get input from them and then do whatever it is. But it has to be, the bill requires you to be as closely related to what the donor originally intended as you can get it to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that, I think that answers my question. I was assuming that the answer might be that
it's really designed to get back to that definition of an endowment. If the donors come in and they put anything in their communication to you that says they want this to be an endowment, then it's permanent unless they tell you it's something else.
So, Mr. Chairman, to clarify, in order to get out of the permanent duration, you're subject to the provisions which are on the next page, which are 1370.040, and that would be the way that you would then end.
The only way to get out is to wind up in court over it, or unless it's a small endowment, then there's an expedited procedure.
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Mr. Lynch? Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Eric Wolforth, are you with us?
If Eric is not there, I can speak to his issue.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Lynch.
Eric, I think, wanted to talk to the committee about the default nature of the legislation. Essentially, if there are other rules in place, other governing documents, other laws that affect some of these endowments, then the other provisions apply first and not of MIFA. And it's really designed for, you know, some of these can actually come in and be formal trusts, or the donor provides most institutions have donor agreements with their donors, where they define what it is they're going to do or not do and how it's going to function. And all of those agreements take precedence over what's in the statute. The statute is default legislation. If that hasn't been agreed to in advance, this is what the rules are. Essentially, that's what that one does.
Well, thanks again. Grant Callow, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Could you please say your name and affiliation?
Yes. This is Grant Callow. I am a life member of the Commission on Uniform Laws and was present during the enactment of MIFA, and I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have, and particularly what I think I can offer is some insight into how this bill came about, how the drafting process, and so if there's anyone there who has any questions about the care with which this was drafted. I just spoke to the Chicago office, the central office for the Commission on Uniform Laws, and learned that we now have had, in the past week, another enactment. Kentucky has just enacted up MIFA, and it's been signed into law. And so now Alaska is really, I think it's one of five jurisdictions that still has not enacted a MIFA. As I think has been mentioned, this bill would provide much more flexibility to persons who are managing institutional funds, but also provide some controls on the delegation of the management of that funds. And I would say this, that it also encourages gift giving and charity in this state, because it provides the means of giving more confidence to donors that their charitable contributions will be carefully managed and used to serve the purposes and goals that they had in mind when they give to the charity. And when we're talking about, there were obviously a number of, maybe not so obviously, but there were many institutional advisors that were involved in the drafting of this, and I can tell you that there's been some reference to the Attorney General's office having a role in enforcing some of the provisions of MIFA. Deborah Baer who some of you know, Assistant Attorney General, is also a commissioner to the Commission on Uniform Laws. I guess she's not here today. I'm in regular contact with her, and I can tell you that the Attorney General's office, staff in AG's office has looked at this, and they have no problem with the role that they would play. And to the extent that there are other jurisdictions that have a MIFA that provide some advantage, I think here in Alaska we would really like to have our institutional funds managed here rather than elsewhere. And I think that enacting a MIFA will help ensure that goal is met, and further will minimize any chance that there is a conflict of laws if there are some funds that are managed outside the state but benefiting or for persons in the state. There could be a question of if there's to the extent that there would be a distinction between the law of that state that might have a MIFA in Alaska would not have it, there could be an issue of conflicts of law. And that is the reason why this law is, or that's one of the reasons why this law is designated as uniform law, to have uniformity among the states. I should finally, I just want to mention that in addition to being adopted, I believe it was unanimously by the states at the Commission on Uniform Laws, it was then sent to the ABA, American Bar Association, House of Delegates, where it was approved there as well. So this has been a very popular bill and hasn't proven very controversial, and I just wanted to provide that by way of background, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Any questions for Mr. Callow? Somebody seems to have a BlackBerry on, Representative Holmes.
Mine's off, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, just checking. Oh, maybe somebody online. Thanks again, Mr. Callow. I hear Eric Wolfert may be back.
Back, Mr. Chair, and I would, if I may, simply add my voice to those who've already spoken. I'm in a doctor's office, and I have to sign off right now as the doctors come in.
Oh. But I think Jim Lynch covered for you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
We have nobody else online. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the committee for discussion. What's the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy.
Happy enough to move it?
I'm happy enough to move it. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 416, 26 LS 1591R from committee with attached zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
And seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. The second item on the agenda today is HCR 21 Economic Development Planning Commission. And with us, we have Rob Earle, staff to Representative Herron, and Aaron Harrington, staff to Representative Alan Osterman. Welcome back, and please state your name and affiliations and tell us all about the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rob Earle, staff Representative Herron. HCR 21 is sponsored by the House Community Regional Affairs Committee, which is co-chaired by Representatives Herron and Munoz. But Representative Osterman's office has also been very instrumental in bringing this forward and working this legislation. We have a little PowerPoint here for you, Mr. Chairman. Components of the bill creates a 10-member Economic Development Planning Commission in the legislative branch. It's going to act as sort of a filter and a bridge to bring forward some of these ideas that are going around the state, to sort of synthesize that and come up with policy suggestions and draft legislation possibly for the legislature to consider. And the commission will report to LBNA, the governor, and Ledge Council, and it sunsets in June of 2012. And now, if I can turn it over to Aaron for a while here.
Welcome back, Aaron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Aaron Harrington. I'm staff representative Alan Osterman. So, as Rob mentioned, the purpose of this is to try to integrate the legislature into some of the ongoing statewide economic development planning processes. We wanted to talk to you for a minute about what some of those processes are. Alaska Forward is one that you have all likely received in your offices, a report from both probably an executive summary and a larger report. This is an effort that's been led by the Alaska Partnership for Economic Development, which is an umbrella organization representing the ARDRs. These are the regional development organizations that operate around the state. There's also membership from other organizations. I believe that Wayne Stevens, who's here in the audience as the president of the Alaska Chamber of Commerce, has been involved in that initiative, as have others. That effort has been funded through $500,000 grant that was provided by the Denali Commission. That was their phase one effort. They're currently working on their phase two funding and will be kicking off that effort, which will result in what are likely to be substantive recommendations in the spring. That will be the launch date. Another initiative that's going on is the Governor's Legacy Initiative. I believe you've probably seen presentations on that as well. Resulted from an administrative order from Governor Palin's administration. The project is morphing under the current governor, and it is they're making efforts to align that more closely with some of what's going on at Alaska Forward, but they also have had significant work groups and significant work products from a number of those work groups. There are a lot of other regional industry-specific efforts, and many of these are ongoing. This chart here will just give you a really quick overview of what some of those are. I'm not going to belabor this, but I think the takeaway point from this is just that there are numerous efforts in entities around the state that try to work on economic development. They don't necessarily all have the opportunity to come and work with you in the legislature, though. We've had this question come up. Is there a need for an Economic Development Planning Commission? And to try to address that question, the ongoing economic development efforts in the state represent a pretty significant investment of effort and financial resources by a number of organizations. And this commission gives the opportunity for the legislature to be engaged throughout that throughout these processes, and particularly in the implementation. Also ensures that legislative action that may respond to some of the needs that are identified in through these efforts is informed by the private sector. And you'll see that the commission consists of a number of private sector individuals in addition to the legislative members. And importantly, this responds to an identified shortcoming in a number of previous economic development efforts that was raised in the course of doing research over the past year related to economic development in the state of Alaska, where it was found that in some cases where legislative action was needed, it wasn't necessarily forthcoming because the legislature hadn't had an opportunity to participate proactively in some of these processes. Some of the kinds of opportunities that the commission may identify, this draws in part from what's occurred in other states, may identify financial tools to target particular areas. This could be sectors or regions of economic development. It could be loan programs, incentives, tax programs. It could target particular industry clusters, particular geographic regions, or help achieve other policy goals. Could also enable the legislature to address some of these identified needs by actually preparing legislation in advance of session so that the important work that's done by these groups has a chance to be brought up and treated through the legislative cycle. And then another opportunity that may be identified is if there's a need to restructure some of the departments that are involved in economic development, this group might be able to look at some of those options. A few options for what those might look like are up there, but you know, we certainly don't know what this commission will ultimately find as needed. I'd like to hand it back over to Rob, if that's okay.
Thank you, Erin. This slide shows the appointment authority for the commission. You can see there'll be eight different legislators appointing six public members, so we hope that would lead to a diversity of geographical representation, as well as experiences and industry representation. And the two commissioners there are just automatically on the commission.
So the House Labor and Commerce Chair doesn't have the ability to appoint anybody?
An oversight on our part, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Can I ask one question on this slide, sir? Could you tell me of those appointments, which one is the interior represented underneath those? Because I don't think it's any of them.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the way that the commission is structured, it does not currently have geographic definitions for those appointments. I believe what Rob was saying is that with finance co-chairs of both bodies, as well as the speaker and the Senate president and the minority leaders from both bodies making appointments, it's hoped that through that there will achieve some diversity. But as it stands right now, there's no geographic definition of the membership.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the Alaska Forward Phase 1 report is coming out here, or it came out last month, and we have that in front of us. The earliest the commission would begin work would be April 30th, were this to become law.
And hopefully that'll be after the end of session.
Hopefully. Phase two, Alaska Ford, should launch sometime here in the spring, probably the late spring, maybe the summer. And then the commission would report, their first legislative report would be right at the beginning of next session. And then the second reporting deadline is right before session 2012. And then the commission would sunset, as mentioned, next summer, summer after next. This slide just kind of shows that there's a consensus building that Alaska could certainly use a little more cohesion in their economic development planning. The Ada strategic plan just came out this spring as well. They mentioned that in their plan. Alaska Ford mentions it, and then the State Chamber of Commerce position paper mentions the need for that as well. Just a little look at all the documents in your packet, Mr. Chairman. Most of these have been mentioned already, but I'd like to point out the last two. There's a legislative research report on economic development organizations that Representative Herron's office ordered recently. And also there's Alan Osman's website has an economic development library that is worth looking at. And as for the fiscal note, it's $130,000 for 2 years, so that'd be $260,000. The bulk of that is for Range 21 Step C to staff the commission. And you can see there's a little bit of a travel budget and per diem budget there as well. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we stand open for questions.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. What is the purpose for doing this? I mean, my understanding, I know that was kind of a broad question, but my understanding is we have a lot of arters and people already doing economic development. And when I read that, it's to try to get them to all come together and talk about what they're doing and strategizing and so we're not duplicating. Is that what you're trying to do?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. No, actually, this organization does not have membership from the ARTRs. This is legislators and then representatives of the private sector. And so the goal of it is to try to develop the legislative actions that will result from the recommendations that are coming out of a number of processes that are going on. So it allows the legislature to engage in these processes proactively and then make recommendations to the larger bodies about things that might be implemented through the legislative process, including possibly department restructuring if that's deemed to be appropriate.
Who currently is in charge of economic development in the administration? Is there a department for that or someone in charge of that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development does work on economic development in the state of Alaska. Through the course of, I can give you a little bit of background on this. Representative Osterman, who I work for, chairs the House Finance Subcommittee on DCCED. And through the course of reviewing their budget last year and then again this year and then through the course of interim work that was done, it came to his attention. He felt very strongly that there were not adequate resources being applied to economic development. And in fact, that group had only about a dozen people that were dedicated to economic development. And so during interim, he worked with Community and Regional Affairs to try to identify tools to help up that effort. This is one of those recommendations to try to give the legislature a manner to be proactively involved in helping to restructure what's going on and to get input from the private sector and perhaps assist with growing that a little bit. So that's the background.
One more?
Yeah, one more. I guess my issue with this, I agree that we need to know whatever, the more we know about economic development that's happening in all parts, I'm 100% on that page.
the makeup of this, I'm not, because it's very political when you start each person appointing somebody else. But my real question is that up in Fairbanks, we have an ARDER, and I'm sure a lot of others do, who are doing work within their communities. You know, that I don't think they report, I don't know whether they report to anybody or not, to be honest. I'm sure there's some kind of report that's done. I'm just wondering why we're not utilizing those types who are already in the private sectors in their own community, as well as using public monies, instead of going out and looking for others and still maybe not necessarily knowing what they're doing.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the ARDERs, there are, I believe, 12 of them in the state right now, and they receive a little less than $60,000 annually from the state. Ones that are fortunate enough to be located in larger areas, including the one that represents Representative Osterman's district, have been able to draw on greater resources. A number of them have very limited resources and, in fact, have only been able to employ part-time people to do the work for sometimes very significant geographic regions. And they also work regionally, and that's part of why they tried to form this Alaska Partnership for Economic Development group to try to develop some statewide ideas, but they operate with pretty significantly different resources, and I think importantly are not perhaps well equipped to be doing things such as drafting legislation to actually implement their ideas. And so that's what this commission will be able to do. It will be able to draw on the resources of the legislature through its legislative members and work to implement some of the ideas that are being produced by this volunteer organization at the legislative level.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn, followed by Representative Holmes, followed by Representative Booth.
I hope you wrote that down.
I am.
Thank you. I thank everybody at this table. Supports economic development and so on. I would certainly hope so, but it just seems like another organization doing what all of us want to do anyway. I have no problem in my office speaking to anybody who wants to do something to increase jobs and economic development and so on. I doubt if anybody else does. I don't think I've had no problem with having representatives of these good groups come in and talk to me about these things, and we can all offer appropriate legislation based upon what we hear. We have a committee in the legislature, House Special Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism. Isn't that what they're supposed to be doing? I mean. Do we really need this? And I don't want to put a red blanket on it, because I'm sure as heck in favor of all these good things. But I'm just having a problem recognizing the need for adding more and more committees for all of us to serve on, other people to work on, and we already have no shortage of these committees out there, all with the same good goal. I guess that wasn't a question so much as a the question, do we really need that to enhance the stage for getting more economic development? Do we really need to have this, or could we spend money someplace else? This is going to cost. This is a resolution, so there's no fiscal note. But is it fiscal note? How much is it? I should look at it. It's zero.
$130,000 per year for 2 years.
$130,000. Well, around this place, that's not much money. But in my experience, the way I grew up, that's a heck of a lot of money for something we're already doing.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to weigh in kind of the same vein as the previous two colleagues. If I can be convinced that this is really going to move the ball forward, I'm 110% behind it. We've got all these different groups, and I heard mention earlier about part of the problem is some of these groups are, they don't really have the time and they don't really have the money. Well, this is a group of people who are not going to be paid. There's going to be one paid staffer, in my understanding. The rest of the people are all volunteers. The fiscal note says they're only going to meet three times a year. They might have teleconferences here and there, but they're only really going to have three meetings a year. These are people with outside jobs, outside duties. This isn't their full-time job. You're only going to have one person with a full-time job of doing this. I appreciate the idea of trying to get the legislature more involved in the process, but I just want to make sure we're not throwing more money after a dream. I mean, if I can really be convinced that this is moving the ball forward, I think it's a great thing, but these are people with outside jobs, outside interests, and I'm just kind of worried that this is just one more group that is going to talk a little bit, and I'm not sure how much we're going to see out of it.
Well, it might be helpful to bring up the fact that we're not going to be moving the bill today, but I will try to get through the amendment.
Okay,
today.
We can do that.
I think we're missing a few other people that would probably like to weigh in. And with that, I'll entertain a motion to adopt amendment, I believe, P1, and we can hear about both P1 and P2.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 1, which is P.1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Who wants to do amendment number 1?
Mr. Chairman, as Aaron mentioned, APED was involved in doing the Alaska Forward project. And so we just feel this the president there would serve well on the commission and be able to offer some insight there. Anything to add, Aaron?
No.
Is there any discussion on amendment number 1? Representative Wilson.
Okay, so we're going to, I guess I just need some clarification. So it would be another position, or we're just saying that the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce.
Another position.
So it was, okay, I'm kind of confused a little bit. So this is going to be a person instead of the Department of Labor?
Mr. Chairman, it would just be an additional person that would automatically be on the commission,
so we are
along with the two
person.
Commissioners.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions on amendment P1?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you. I assume that this is the goal is to further integrate this with ongoing efforts for other things that are already happening.
Mm-hmm. The Alaska Forward is kind of the major project going on, and this would integrate those two.
I have a question.
Representative Wilson.
And is the Alaska Partnership for Economic Development, is that a public or a private company or group?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, Alaska Partnership for Economic Development is the umbrella organization that was recently formed by the ARDRs. And so this, up until the formation of this group, the ARDRs had no opportunities to meet together to discuss what they were learning or working on individually in their regions. APED now creates an opportunity for them to meet, and they are the ones funding the Alaska Forward project.
Thank you. Follow-up. Well, no, my follow-up has nothing to do with the amendment, so I'll have to hold it.
New question.
I'm fine.
Is there any further opposition to this? Well, I'll remove my opposition, and amendment number 1 will pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes.
I would like to move amendment number 2, that is P.2.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
P.2.
Mr. Chairman, this was actually suggested by a member of the other body, and maybe you can't appoint a member, but at least the commission will be reporting to the House Labor and Commerce and the Senate Labor and Commerce committees.
Any further discussion on this?
That works for me.
Any further objection? Representative Ramirez, care to join us? No further opposition. I'll lift my opposition, and amendment number 2 will pass. And with that, we're going to hold the bill over and take a brief at ease. New bill. Next item is House Bill 389, Commercial Fishing Loan Act. And we have Katie today. It'll be shorter than having Representative Seaton, I suspect. Please state your name and affiliation, and you have our undivided attention, Katie.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Katie Kester, staff to Representative Seaton. House Bill 389 is a bill an idea that was brought to Representative Seaton by a constituent, and basically the point of this legislation is to encourage the use and purchase of Alaska-manufactured products in Alaska's commercial fishing vessel fleets. House Bill 389 allows the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Investments, to offer a rate reduction of up to 2% if a borrower purchases a product that was manufactured in Alaska with the proceeds of their commercial fishing fund loan. There's about 7 or 8 programs underneath the commercial fishing loan fund. This would only apply to 2 of them, the product quality and engine efficiency replacement programs. The product quality program is for purchasing things that improve the quality of your catch. So that would be slush bags, which I learned what those were from my boss, bags where you can kind of put the ice and the fish in together to keep the ice from bruising the fish, and then you get a higher price for them at market. Refrigeration units, those are in the some examples in the product quality program. The engine efficiency program would be for the replacement of an engine for a more fuel efficient engine. Under House Bill 389, at least 50% of the proceeds of the loan need to be spent on an Alaska manufactured product. Often a good portion of the proceeds from a loan is spent on labor to install the product. So at least 50% of that loan would need to be spent here in Alaska on the actual manufactured project. Often if it's installed in Alaska, that service funds are also spent in Alaska. The definition of manufactured or produced is spelled out in the legislation as processing, developing, or making an item into a new item with a distinct character and use. That's taken from procurement statute and code, so that's a definition of Alaska manufacturer that the state is familiar with. The one big caveat of this program is it's a voluntary program for the Division of Investments to institute. Right now, the market is prime is so low that they really cannot offer this rate reduction without it jeopardizing the solvency of the fund, and that's not something we want to do because it's a very important fund. So when the market improves, they would be able to institute this reduction to encourage manufacture products purchased in Alaska. And this is a small thing that that we can do to help with Alaska manufacture products and help with our industry and economic development, which is a theme the committee has been working on. So we have Greg Winninger, the director of Division of Investments, available for questions. And of course, I am available for any of the committee's questions.
Any questions for Katie?
This is so easy.
I'm showing nobody in the audience. So we have somebody online. What did you say we had?
Greg Winninger is the director of Division of Investments, and he is here in the audience in a lovely striped tie.
Might as well bring him up. Come on up, Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greg Winninger, director of the Division of Investments. I don't have any prepared testimony, but we certainly support the concept and have no problem answering any questions you might have about the fund or how this works. As Katie mentioned, it's something that wouldn't kick in right away because we have very, very low rates in effect already for these types of loans, but this is something that we anticipate at some point interest rates are going to go back up again, and that would give us the opportunity to go through a regulations process and provide lower rates for products manufactured in the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Wilson.
Since you got him up here.
Parts manufactured in the interior? Or,
I'm sure somewhere in somebody's house, sir. I was just curious, because this is on new loans. Every year, would they have the 2%? Taken off, or would they have to prove something every year? How would it actually work?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, basically it's a rate that's established at the time you take out the loan. And so if it met the criteria at that point, your rate would stay in effect for the life of the loan. We also have a pay on time program, which is kind of a little bit separate, but if you pay on time, we actually can reduce your rate by 1 percentage point more. And that's something we do look at each year.
Thank you.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Speaker Chenault, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And going to that, the topic of the pay on time and other rates, are these cumulative? Is it possible that you would apply, that you would qualify for the 2% and then also get the 1% on top, or are these one or the other?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that's correct. They're cumulative. So basically, you get the 2%, and then if you make that first payment timely, we drop your rate another point for the following year.
Cool. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody online that for the bill, and is there anybody else in the room? With that, I'm going to close out public testimony on it and hold it over until I have a full committee. I know there's a couple people on the committee that are absent today that want to weigh in. Fortunately, we've got a light enough calendar and a few more days that we should have no problem getting to it. But, that brings up, thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 269, Economic Stimulus Bonds Reallocation Waiver. It looks like it's going to be Jerry today. How you doing, Jerry?
Pretty good. Come on up. I'm going to let Devin Mitchell speak to it.
Okay, that'll work. Popping it off, huh?
Yeah.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Devin Mitchell. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank. And employee in the Department of Revenue. And I understand I was out of town, but the committee already heard the companion bill, House Bill 338, and unless there were specific questions relating to Senate Bill 269, it essentially does the same types of things that you learned about last week. So,
does everybody remember this bill from last week? Thank you for the compelling testimony. is there anybody online that cares to testify? Who do we have? Catherine Dodge, are you with us?
I am.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for participating today.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Catherine Dodge. I'm with the Fairbanks North Star Borough Economic Development. I'm one of those ARDRs you were speaking about. And I'm just calling to state my support for this bill as amended. It's good for our state, and it makes good use of resources. Short and sweet.
Oh, that's perfect. Any questions for Ms. Dodge? Thanks again. Anybody else online? Anybody else in the room? Anybody who's changed their mind since the last time we heard this bill? With that, I'm going to close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Representative Wilson.
Would you like to move it before we change our minds? I mean, would you like to move, sir?
Please.
I'd like to move CS for Senate Bill number 269, 26-G, S2880/E from committee with individual recommendations and any fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. Brief at ease. Last item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 272, Rental Car Charges. Edra, are you going to be hearing this one?
I am. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Huggins. He couldn't be here today due to scheduling conflicts. This is also just a real quick, short and sweet bill, so that's good.
Give us a chance, we'll make it more complicated. Yeah. Everybody got the amendments ready? Please continue.
Okay. Senate Bill 272 is an act relating to charges for rented motor vehicles, including cost recovery fees and making a violation of the rented motor vehicle charge provisions an unfair trade practice. As an industry standard, rental car companies assess cost recovery fees in addition to government taxes and surcharges. Alaska law is currently silent on the issue of separately listed charges on car rental statements, which means that companies can currently charge consumers for the recovery of fees and not have to disclose them or list them separately. SB 272 would require those fees to be listed separately and clearly identified on the rental car agreement. In addition, it would make violating the provision an unfair trade practice. SB 272 is a consumer protection bill modeled on car rental legislation passed in 30 other states, 10 of which passed similar legislation in just the past 3 years alone. The bill has passed the Senate unanimously, has industry support, as well as the support of the Department of Law. With that, I thank you for your time and encourage the committee support on SB 272. And if you have any technical questions, I believe we have Shane Skinner from the, Enterprise Holdings online willing to testify.
Any questions? Representative Booth.
Mr. Chairman, refresh my memory. A couple years ago, didn't we have a bill that was a disclosure bill similar to this regarding a fee? And we made it against the law for the sale of a vehicle. They had to disclose some similar documentation fee,
yeah,
where they were charging, and come to find out it was just a way to get a few extra bucks without actually not doing anything.
But I believe that was on the car dealers and not the car rental agencies.
Right. That was actually a sale.
Yeah, it was a documentation.
And so this is a similar provision regarding disclosure on only car rentals, as far as I can read this. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Book. On page 2, line 19, under definitions, item 1, car, means a motor vehicle. We've spoke to the drafter about that very question, whether or not this bill would apply to all motor vehicle rentals. And the drafter has confirmed that this definition here does make that apply to all motor vehicle rentals.
All motor vehicle rentals?
Yes.
Not sales?
Not sales.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? And who do we have online?
Hi, Mr. Chair. This is Shane Skinner from Enterprise Rent-A-Car.
Oh, welcome, Shane.
And, thank you. And I just like to follow up with Edra. I think this is a great bill. There's currently nothing on the books, and this clarifies a lot of the allowable charges, and it also limits those charges to what is remitted to the state in all three cases. Those cases being the car rental fee, car rental taxes, which are remitted to the state, the airport taxes and fees, which are remitted to the airports to run the facilities, and the registration vehicle registration licensing costs, which are remitted to the state. And it caps the amount that's allowable to be collected to those amounts that are remitted to the state or the airport authority. And I'll take any questions.
Any questions? Well, thanks again for being available.
No, great. Thank you.
Is there anybody else online? Nobody else online. Is there anybody in the room? Madeline, you want to? No? Seeing nobody in the room, I think we'll close out public testimony. We have no amendments. We'll bring back the committee for discussion. Representative Wilson.
How about we move this one out too, sir?
Oh, you're on a roll.
I am. So I'd like to move Senate Bill number 272-26-LS-1393/A with individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee and we will adjourn much earlier than I thought we were going to be doing at 2:15.